I speak at this level, try and sit in such a way that I see you're doing it right at the moment. Good. So I'm going to talk about vision today, beyond the retina, how neurons in the brain act as the building blocks for perception. And normally, to cover the material that he got me to do today, you'd need at least 3 hours. Don't worry, I'm not going to speak fast and try and get it all in 1.5 hours. We'll finish at 10:45 for sure. And there are two possibilities. The first lecture, which the boss told me to give, concerns a really fascinating topic that I'll tell you about in a minute. And if we have enough time at the end of that, I'll show you a movie which is marvelous, which shows you the responses of the cells that we've been talking about. But I can't promise to do that, because it depends on the timing, and it depends on you, because I would like you to interrupt me during this talk if you want to. So interrupt, ask questions. Be a merit to our European students. So the first topic concerns the development of the visual system after birth and the role of experience in forming the nervous system. This is a really major question for thinking about the brain. Do you think that when you're born, all the connections that are required for you to be able to see are present at birth? Connection that enables you to see that as vertical, that as horizontal, that as oblique. Is that already there? Or does that develop as a result of your seeing trees, horizons, and all the visual stimuli that you receive in early life? Which is it? You can't answer this question unless you know about the experiments that I'm telling you about today. And another question. You know that you have two eyes on your head. And you know that each of them sees a slightly different aspect of the outside world. Yet, you have one image in your mind's eye. Somehow, the two eyes come together perfectly. This is very different from the somatosensory system, because if somebody squeezes your two hands, you don't get a sensation in the middle of your body, usually. But the visual system then is different from somatosensory in this regard. And one wonders how it comes about that you see a single image instead of two images, as a frog would see with his eye, what he would, sorry, he'd see two different worlds out there. So the work I've been talking about follows from what you've already heard about the retina. And all the work that I'll be discussing in the beginning part of the talk was done by these two people, David Hubel on the left and Thorsten Wiesel on the right, both of whom got Nobel Prizes, and I think one can say without exaggeration that they certainly could have got 2 Nobel Prizes for the work they did. Because the first thing they did was unravel the connections between the eye, the lateral geniculate nucleus, and the cortex. And they studied principally this region here, the visual cortex, where the input from the eye arrives by way of the lateral geniculate nucleus. So the question we're asking at the beginning of this talk is, to what extent are all these connections formed at the time of birth? Are the properties of the cells here the same when you're born, or do they develop as a result of your seed? The old question of nature versus nurture. What you're born with compared to what happens to you. Now this picture shows the anatomy. And we have to discuss the anatomy before we do the physiology. Oh, how boring. No, it isn't boring. You can't do any physiology without anatomy. And the great achievement of Hubel and Wiesel was to know the right amount of anatomy. Not to go into endless detail, but there are certain things you must know. And from the beginning, you see something really interesting here, which you know already. The output from the two eyes splits at the chiasm in such a way that the right half of each retina goes to the right cerebral cortex, and the left half of each retina goes to the left cortex. And this slide shows you the complete uselessness of philosophy for understanding how the brain works. Philosophy is completely valueless. Why? This picture shows you that everything you see in the left side of the world is being treated in the right half of the brain. Everything you see in the right side of the world is being analyzed by the left side of the brain. This crossing at the chiasm is perfect. Now, the connections are so beautiful that you cannot tell that they're there. If I do this, you don't say, ooh, right eye, right eye, right eye, right eye, oops, left eye, left eye, sorry, right cortex, right cortex, right cortex, right cortex, left cortex, left cortex. You don't know that. And no amount of thinking can tell you that if you don't know how the fibers cross at the chiasm. This shows the awfulness of people like Goethe, who was, they say, a fine poet. But he also thought he was a great universal genius, and that you didn't need to do experiments. They were rather dirty things. The great mind could think about how the brain worked, and therefore find out things.
Where in the circuit does the one eye dominance come in?
You're asking a very sophisticated question, which I'm not going to answer now, and probably not at all. Okay, we're dealing with absolutely basic things. I'm grateful for your question, but it is several steps ahead of what we're doing. You will see eye dominance in a moment. So, Hubel and Wiesel set out to find the mechanisms by which the cortex analyzes signals coming to it. Now, you know already from the lectures you've heard that the eye is a fantastic instrument. It could not be a better instrument for the purposes that it serves. But what does the cortex do? What are the cells there like? The great impetus for the work by Hubel and Wiesel was experiments done by their boss, Stephen Kuffler, who was working on the retina at a time when nothing was known about its circuitry. In fact, here's a homely lesson. You start working on something and you think nothing is known about it. It's wrong. A lot is known, but it's wrong. So there was a lot of wrong information about the retina before Kuffler. And he said, let's cut through all that nonsense and I'll see what happens in these nerve fibers. And the optic nerve fibers, as I think you know, respond not to diffuse light, light on, light off, but what they like is contrast. And the ideal stimulus for a ganglion cell in the retina is a small dark spot or a small light spot. And it lights a small dark spot surrounded by light, or a small light spot surrounded by dark. So as you look at me now, seeing all the wealth of the picture in front of you, with its colours, its movement, its depth, all that is coming about through signals that are action potentials, which are the same throughout nerve fibers of the body, and they're carrying information about little pixels. But they're not saying, is this pixel illuminated or not? They're saying, is there contrast here? Hubel and Wiesel knew that, and that's where they started to analyze what was happening. So what we're doing is now, in 10 minutes or so, going over what should be a 2-hour lecture on the responses of cells. And why are we doing that? Because if we want to see how mature the visual system is in the newborn animal, we have to know what it's like in the adult. Otherwise, how can we do it? Is that clear? We have to know what the adult is like before we know what the baby is like. So Hubel and Wiesel's immense achievement was making sense of what happens here. Once again, it's not that nobody had investigated this, but a bunch of bananas had screwed the whole field up. Hubel and Wiesel did this in an extraordinary way. They said, let's look at one cell at a time and see for each cell what kind of visual stimulus does it like. This is an amazing approach. Imagine you have the good fortune to be Torsten Wiesel, you're going to work with David Hubel, and you say, well, what should we do? He says, I propose that we look at one cell at a time in the visual cortex. You say, what? You're crazy. If we work on cats, then in a cat we can get 50 cells, if we're lucky. We'll do 2 cats a week, that's a lot of work. 100 cells a week. 2 weeks holiday a year, so we get 5,000 cells a year. Work for 20 years, get 100,000 cells, which is what you get in a bit of brain about a cubic millimeter in size. Thank you very much, I'll go somewhere else. But they did it. And this is still the only technique, and that's why the field has progressed so little beyond their work done 40 years ago or so. But their work was dead right. And unlike the work of if somebody else repeats it, they get the same result. So let's see what they got. They were interested then in the cortex, and first they needed to know the anatomy. The input output of the eye goes to the lateral tunicular nucleus, which has 6 layers. And each layer receives input from one eye, but not the other. So the 2 inputs are segregated. Left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, in 6 layers. Clear to everybody? So the single image is not happening there. Where does it happen? In the cortex. And for this, we need to know something about the anatomy of the cortex. Amazing studies were done. This is a terrible color. Amazing studies were done at the beginning of the last century by Brodmann and Campbell, just looking at the cortex, area by area by area. You'd never get funded for that today. But it was absolutely fundamental. And what they saw was that if you look at the cortex, you find an area here which looks different from the areas around it, call it 17 or striate cortex. Here there's 18 and so on and so forth. And in each part of the cortex, doesn't matter where you look, there are 6 layers. Oh, how boring. No, it's not boring. And in this 4th layer, the genicular fibers in. So the fibers are coming from here, segregating, and end here. And they were able to show, much later actually, but the input here is also segregated. So this is left eye, and that's right eye. These are genicular axons coming up and forming endings. And the other eye is like this. We're discussing the situation in the adult now. So we're saying that if you were to look actually at a stained genicular axon, it would look like that. And the one from the other eye would look like that. And there would be no overlap between them in the cortex. What on earth is he telling us? Going to this level of detail, who cares? You do. Because one of the features that they showed was that the properties of the cells in layer 4 were different from those above and below. If you look in layer 4, what would you expect? Would you expect a cell that sits here to be driven by both eyes or by one eye? Anybody? Would you think likely to be driven by one eye or by both eyes? We've got separate groupings, left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye. Do you think the cells are going to be driven by both eyes or by one eye? Hello? We're in America, we're not in Europe. Remember, you don't get marked by me. I don't care. If you get it wrong, it's even better. The best thing you can do is give a wrong answer. Wrong. Good. Good that you got it wrong. You see, you've got that input coming from the genetic here. A cell that sits there is only going to get input from these fibers, not from those that are over there. Okay? Good idea, but wrong. I'm praising you, not blaming you. But it's up here that the cell is driven by both eyes, because it can get input from left eye and from right eye. So we're making a generalization now. We're saying throughout 1, 2, 3, and 5, 6, but not 4, the cells are driven by both eyes, for the most part. So let's take a cell here, a particular cell in the cortex, that one. And we'll say its name is Lucinda. So we put an electrode next to Lucinda, and we say, what does Lucinda like in order to fire? And we said the retina cells like small spots. It doesn't do much to Lucinda. And you can listen to action potentials, because they make a sound if you use an audio amplifier, and you find then that you need a particular stimulus to make Lucinda fire. And actually, this is what I want to show you the movie afterwards, if we have time. So we've got an electrode next to Lucinda, we're recording its pattern of activity, her pattern. And we hear, brr, 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 brr. Lucinda's action potential, which is the same as every other action potential, says there is a vertical bar of light here in the retina. Next to Lucinda sits Henry. And Henry doesn't give a damn about a vertical bar of light. He cares about a horizontal bar of light. And so the fundamental properties of these cells in the adult are that they don't care about diffuse light at all. You can turn the light on and off, it doesn't make any difference. But these cells care about the orientation of a stimulus. And it must be in a particular place. Okay? Questions? But these cells have another property. They are driven by both eyes. So let's look at Lucinda. Lucinda likes a vertical bar of light just here in the retina. Brup, 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 brup. driven by both eyes, not just by one eye. The majority of cells are driven by both eyes. In layer 4, they're driven either by the left eye or by the right eye. Oh, how tedious this is. No, it isn't. And now comes something frightful. I would like, if I was Obama or Stalin or somebody, I would ban all histograms. I would never allow anybody to show a histogram. It's the most aversive way of teaching it's possible. But I have to show this one. This shows the number of the record, a number of recordings made by Hubel and Beeson, hundreds and hundreds of cells. And they're grouping the cells into different categories. And they're saying category number 1 is driven only by the eye on the same side. Category number 7 only by the other eye. And all of these are driven by both eyes. This is driven equally well by both. This better by the left eye, this better by the right eye. Is that clear? So this histogram is empirically derived. You just find out how many cells, which is better driven by left eye. So one driven better by the left eye would not be Lucinda or Henry, but let's say Fred. So Fred is better driven by left eye. Brr, 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 pop, pop, brr, brr. This grouping then is important. But now, can you actually see this grouping in the brain? Hubel and Beeson, it's never enough just to see something physiologically. They want to see it anatomically. And then they do the most... Yes, good, good, good.
Are there cells that require input from both eyes? Or?
Yes. Right, there are.
Are they driven by either or does, are there ones that require input from both eyes?
Yeah. Those are different cells that are driven by both eyes. The ones we're talking about don't necessarily have to be driven by both eyes, but there is a class. Okay, you tell me, because you said that good thing, you're building the nervous system. Which cells will you make driven by both eyes for depth perception? The ones that tell you how near or how far something is. We can discuss that later. So they wanted to actually see these columns of cells. You can see that there's a column of cells here. There are columns that go up and down where the cells are better driven. Here, they'll all be better driven by the left eye, here better by the right eye. And they wanted to see these columns anatomically. So they did this daring experiment. They injected radioactive amino acids into this eye, bromine. It was transported along there in the form of protein here. It crossed the synapse and the radioactivity ended up here. And the way we see this on the next slide, which looks confusing but isn't, is imagine you have a chocolate cake with cream in the middle layer. Chocolate cake, cream in the middle. Layer 4 is the cream. Now you take off the top bit and look down on layer 4. Clear? And what you see is left and right eye, left and right eye, left and right eye, equal territories for both. Any questions at this stage? But this experiment, you should think about a bit. Just before you ask your excellent question, keep the question for a second. You should think about it because it's amazing. It tells you that they injected radioactive amino acids. They were incorporated into proteins. The protein was carried across a synapse. How much do you hear in your lectures about transsynaptic transfer of proteins? You don't. But it could be terribly important. And we just don't know about it. But Hubel and Beeson, together with Bernice Grafstein, were the first people to describe this. And since then, it's just died as an idea. But it shouldn't. Now your question.
All right, maybe I should pick this up earlier or ask earlier. When you say left eye, right eye, you mean the left portion of both eyes versus the right portion of both eyes. Is that correct?
No.
So, okay.
I mean left I's input to this cell, which would be, if we're dealing with the right hemisphere, would be coming from the right half of that eye. Good question. Somebody else had a question? Okay, so...
Actually, I have a question.
Illegal, but you may.
I'm just wondering, at the time that they published this experimental result, was it widely accepted that their method actually... Did people accept that, yes, these radioactive proteins will be transferred across the synapse, or did they have to do more to show that this wasn't occurring because of some spurious kind of uptake?
Sorry, you have to do better than that for me.
Because this was a novel.
They showed the result. Now you flustered at the end.
You what?
She flustered around. Instead of speaking articulate good English, she said, or was it because of something, or was it because of what?
Some experimental artifact.
Tell me what artifact could do
that. That perhaps it was taken up by another route other than the optic track.
But you could see it in the geniculate, too. You could see the layering in the geniculate. I just didn't mention that. But you'd be hard put to find an alternative explanation. What you could do is what the bananas did at the time, said, I don't believe their results. They only got that once. But they were wrong, the bananas. It was dead right, and everybody could repeat it. So now what we've done is we've said we know the situation roughly in the adult. And this is cat or monkey. Now let's look and see what happens in the newly born animal that has never seen anything. That's what we're working towards. This first part should have taken 3 hours, and it would have been fascinating if given properly. You get the question? Now we start looking at newly born animals that have seen nothing. And they worked with kittens and newly born monkeys. Now these animals are born at different stages of development. So the monkey's pretty mature when he's born. He can see, he looks around. The kitten, as you probably know, has his lids closed at birth. And they only open after a few days. Animals differ a lot in their degree of maturity at birth. But those of you that went to my talk heard that the opossum is born at a very... It's born as an embryo. Another interesting animal is the guinea pig. Anybody seen a guinea pig be born? It's amazing. A guinea pig, when it's born, comes out. It's not a nasty little pink thing like a rat that's born. Has hair on, smooths its hair, finds a rabbit and goes and chases a woman immediately. They're extraordinarily mature, these animals. So they have different degrees of maturity. There's a difference between kitten and monkey. But they looked at both. I'll talk mainly about monkey. So the question is, what will we find? And in the monkey, what you find is that a monkey that's never, ever seen anything, they rush it up to the experimental lab after it's been born, or even take it out by cesarean section to make sure it saw nothing. They then start recording from the retina. From the geniculate. And from the cortex. And the great art of doing science is to do the important experiments and not get bogged down with irrelevant details. You have to know which details are important and which ones are just fancy. So they looked at the retina and the output of an eye, and they found that it was just about the same as in the adult. They don't say it's exactly the same. And of course you could find a graduate student you hate and get them to see in what way it's different. But they didn't do that sort of experiment. Every experiment they did was with their own hands. So they satisfied themselves that the retina was by and large normal. They satisfied themselves that the geniculate was normal. It was layered. And then they came to the cortex. And when they recorded from the cortex here, they found Lucindus, Amandus, Fredericks, all these cells, cells that respond to vertical, horizontal, to oblique, arranged beautifully in columns where each cell had properties similar to its neighbors. But they noticed one difference, and that was in layer four. In layer four, the cells were driven not by both eyes, but by one eye. Sorry, not by one eye, but by both eyes. Sorry, I just did it wrong. So in the newborn, the cortex looks like this. This is layer four. Here, the cells are driven by both eyes, but in layer four, we see this. The fibers coming from the two eyes are not segregated. And the cells here are driven by both eyes, not by one eye. A rather trivial observation. If I had made that, I would have thought it's not important. But they seized on this as a cue to understanding what was happening. Because the genicular fibers here are like that, and like that. Much wider arborizations. And this change happens over the first 6 weeks of life. So in the first 6 weeks of life, you change from left eye, right eye being like that, the cells being binocularly driven, to that, where the arborization becomes smaller and there's no overlap. The fibers retract. Cells don't die, yet some arborization just becomes narrower. Any questions? So now, in summary, we've said the newborn animal comes with this visual system just about intact, with a difference in layer four, with cells being binocularly driven instead of monocularly driven, with geniculate axons with overlapping fields instead of restricted fields. Now, what experiment would you do to see the effect of experience in early life? Anybody? An experiment, please.
One for the kittens.
Good. That's what most people did. It was wrong. It's not a good experiment. But it's good that you said it. Praise to you, but not good. All the bananas were doing that. Better experiment, please, yes?
Expose the mind by verbal or horizontal stimuli.
That's right. And also a good idea, and it's an interesting story. There's a very famous scientist in England called Colin Blakemore, who's the head of the Medical Research Council. He did that experiment. And he showed that the animals then that were brought up with vertical had a cortex where they could only see vertical, not horizontal. The experiments were wrong. Nobody could repeat them. They just weren't right. The experiment was too complicated. And yet he became terribly famous, just like who became terribly famous by doing wrong experiments. If you really want success in life, do wrong experiments that are glamorous. So when I say wrong, I mean that experiment was dead wrong. He got famous, but then people tried to repeat it and couldn't. And in the end, it was such a disgrace that he had to take his animals to Stryer's lab Prince. I get the name wrong. Mike Stryker's lab in San Francisco, and in his present show that he couldn't reproduce. Now, you may be able to see why later, but it's a good idea.
Did you blindfold one eye?
Good. Exactly. And that, did you know that, or did you?
I have a vague recollection of this.
But that's good, because that's the right experiment, because if you do that, you have the other eye as a control. And so what they did, instead of blindfolding, they sewed the lids together. So you sew the lids together of one eye. I'll always do the left eye just for convenience. It doesn't matter which one. Leave the lids closed for 3 weeks. Open the eye. Close the other one and see what happens. And the animal is completely blind in that eye. If you close the eye, say, for 3 months at birth. So the animal that could see when it was born stops being able to see. So what's this due to? Well, they look in the retina. Retina's normal. They look in the geniculum. Geniculum's pretty normal. The cortex, abnormal. None of the cells are driven by the deprived eye. Deprived, the one that was closed. And you can see that in this slide here, where here you see the histogram showing ocular dominance preference. Cells driven only by the left eye, cells driven only by the right eye, cells driven by both eyes. This is the time of closure of the lid. Now this illustrates another feature of these experiments. They didn't do any statistics, ever. Why not? Did they not like statistics? No, but it's ridiculous. You can't do a histogram. You can't do statistics to see if this is different from that. Nobody in his right mind would think you'd need statistics for that. And they are looking for clear yes, no answers. Not maybe, well, it's a little bit better this eye, a little bit. Not so. There's one cell driven by the closed eye. So you have, just by closing the lids of one eye, made the animal blind in that eye, you've changed its cortex. And you change its cortex physiologically. None of the cells are driven by the deprived eye, and you change it morphologically. So if you look here, you remember this is what it looks like in layer 4 in the adult. Left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, the cream layer. It's definitely, you're all writing. I don't know why you're writing. This is all in the books. You can read it in our book from your, if you're writing a letter to your mother, that's fine. I don't know why you're writing. And here is the adult. Now look at the animal that's had the lids closed for 3 months. Can you see the difference? None of this cortex is supplied by the deprived eye. Again, you don't have to do statistics to see if this is different from the previous one. You'd be off your head with these statistics. Now, I think a man who made incredible mischief to human culture in the last century in a destructive way was Sigmund Freud. I think he ruined literature and many other things by his arrogant pronouncements. But Freud did do one, he had marvelous gift with language, and he said something marvelous. Anatomy is destiny. So you have changed the destiny of this animal. You've changed the structure of its brain, not by cutting anything, not by giving it drugs, but simply by reducing the amount of input that comes to one eye. Freud did have one huge achievement. Anybody tell me what Freud's biggest achievement was? Anybody? What did Freud actually do that was great. It's a very great, I think, indication of what our society is like and what we value. Freud, together with colour, discovered local anesthetics. Just think of the human suffering that was avoided and prevented by this tremendous discovery, much more than the damage he did by psychoanalysis. And yet we don't know about that. When I say we, most people don't know it. So he did do some good things. Anyway, here we are with closing the lids of one eye, producing an irreversible blindness in that eye. So Hubel and Wiesel looked to see how long you had to close the lids of the eye. And they showed that you had to close them during the first 3 months for the effect to be valid. If you take a monkey aged 4 months and close the lids for 3 years, open them, you can see perfectly well, and there's no change in the cortex. And this allowed them to say that in early life, there's a critical period and this is about the first 3 months or so of life, and it's not uniform in its sensitivity. If you close the lids of an eye during that period at different stages, you find that at 4 weeks it's extremely sensitive. And Colin Blakemore, who did the experiment with the stripes that was wrong, showed that at 4 weeks, if you close the lids of an eye in a cat, for 48 hours it became irreversibly blind. So in the first 3 months, there's a critical period. So we say in the first 3 months, what's happening? We start off with the geniculate axons overlapping in layer 4, and then go like that. If we use one eye and not the other, that's what happens. Is it light or is it form that matters? Anybody? Which would you think? Is it the light coming into the eye or the patterns? Have a guess. Patterns. Why?
Because I have a sister-in-law who doesn't have vision in one eye, but she had his.
Okay.
That would be my
sister-in-laws teach one the correct answer. But you could guess that because patterns don't matter for the retina, they don't matter for the geniculate, but they do for the cortex, and that's where the lesion is. So you might guess that. And how could they test that? Well, they took a plastic occluder like a ping pong ball, which lets light through but has no shapes, like the wall of a. Like the window of a toilet, which is frosted, like frosted glass. And they put this on, and they saw that was just like closing the lids, even though light was still getting in perfectly well. So then Hubel and Wiesel came up with the idea that what is happening is, in early life, the two eyes are competing for territory. They start off equal. But if one is active and the other isn't, the active one will take over from the other. How could they test this? By the way, this shows why your experiment with a blindfold was not good. Because it didn't have the element of competition in it. And so how you could test this was make the competition equal. And you do that by closing the lids of both eyes. And if you do that in the monkey, the two eyes look perfectly normal, the geniculate looks perfectly normal, the cortex looks like this. In other words, the competition is equal. Nobody gets any advantage over the other. And Hubel and Wiesel of course, like anybody, hoped that their experiments might be useful, although they didn't say all the time, these experiments will be useful for curing this and that. And so they thought maybe children with a squint could be helped, because children who squint with two eyes diverging and converging like that often have a good eye and a bad eye, and they go back, they go blind in one of the eyes, it's not used. And what the doctors did at that time was to patch the good eye so as to make the bad eye work in the hope that would make things better. So they did a nice experiment where they cut an extra ocular muscle in the monkey or the cat, and that meant this eye looks there and sees a frog, while that eye looks straight ahead and sees a cathedral. The two images are no longer superposed. And in that condition too, the cortex looked perfectly normal. The competition here is completely equal. All that's missing is the synchrony in the two eyes, and the territories look equal like that. So now we can say that inappropriate use in early life within a critical period gives rise to irreversible blindness. If you like, in the question period, we discuss how you could reverse this, perhaps. Any questions at this stage? Yes?
So what's, you said that the monkey's age is 3 months for that development. What is it for humans?
What?
What's the age where, like, it becomes irreversible damage? Like, at what point is a human baby old enough
okay.
where it won't?
Okay, very good. How would you study that in a human baby? It's very hard to do. You can't do it. I mean, you can't do experiments on any babies I've had, for sure. So you can't do experiments. But it turns out that Jonathan Portman has made use of a way that allows you to stain the colors in this way. And you can do that in babies that have a problem with one eye or the other eye, and you find the same thing happening. And there is a critical period, but just what you would expect. It's longer, and you don't think of the critical period as starting off like this and then stopping like that. It tapers off. And so it's very hard to define when it ends. But this is coming to the next question, and that is, I think you'll agree that these are very interesting and important experiments and marvelously done. And it's easy to follow these things, but to think of doing them is very different. So the next question would be, how about other systems? Are there other sensory systems that have critical periods? And this has been investigated beautifully in the auditory system by a marvelous scientist who's a good friend at Stanford called Eric Knudsen. Did they learn about auditory system?
No.
So Eric Knudsen is a remarkable scientist. Like Hubel and Wiesel, he does all his own experiments. You might find a Knudsen paper with three authors, but usually himself and somebody else, and sometimes only Knudsen. So he's not one of the gangsters who employs other people to do the work for him. And you'll see the advantage of that. So Knudsen worked on the barn owl, because he'd studied that beforehand in terms of its auditory system. And that had been looked at in great detail by Kanishi. And the owl can track mice by following them with its eyes or with its ears. And you know that you can detect the position of an object by sound. If I do that, it reaches both your ears at the same time. I go to this side of the room, it'll reach one ear before the other ear. If I reach, go to that side, it'll reach the other ear. And there are neurons in the brainstem that compute the time interval between the arrival at one ear and the other ear. And that means, from these time intervals, you can have a map of auditory space. Is that clear? So Knudsen's experiment was designed to see if there was a critical period in these animals which he studied. And the experiment was this. You sit the owl on a perch, the baby newly hatched owl. I keep saying newborn, but I mean newly hatched. Comes out of an egg. Stands there. And you can have a mouse running. And the owl can do an amazing computation. He can calculate exactly where the mouse will be, fly to it, to that spot, and get the mouse. And he can do it without looking at night through the auditory system, because the mouse is going, and he can hear him coming first this ear, then that ear. So he has a map of auditory space, a map of visual space. Clear? And these two maps come together in a structure called the tectum. And in the tectum, then, there's a layer here which gets input from the auditory and from the visual. So there's a map of the outside world, left side, center, right side, which corresponds to input either from the ear or from the eye, and they're correct and superimposed. Is it clear? Yes or no? Looks very bad. Look at the audience now, it looks terrible. So he has here a nice arrangement that allows the owl to hunt using auditory maps or visual maps, determining where the prey is, equally reliable. Now what clever Knudsen does is he puts prisms on the eyes of the owl that deflect the center of vision by 33 degrees. That happens instantaneously. And immediately now, this is the center of the visual field, but that's still the center of the auditory field. Clear? When Torsten Wiesel and I used to teach a course at Harvard, we would put prisms on the eye of a student volunteer, and they would then throw darts at a board here. You put the prism on, and they immediately throw to the right. But a human being can do something the owl can't do. After a bit, you can get the center again. Then you take the prism off. What happens? You do it to the left, and it comes back. Now, in the owl, what Knudsen found was the visual and the optical fields are in register. I'll show it like that. The visual field moves immediately when you put the prism on, at once. Over days and weeks, the auditory field in this layer changes. So the center of the auditory field corresponds to the center of the visual field. Then, if you take the prism off, boom, immediately, the visual field center comes back to where it was, and the auditory field moves to be in register again. And Knudsen, in his first experiments, showed that this critical period for the auditory field to move there and back was during the first 200 days or so of life. Clear? Then he did something which the gangsters who get prizes never do. He did the experiment again. Now, when I say they never do it, they never do the experiment in the first instance, but he did the experiment himself. And you'll see why that's important. You think I'm being funny, but I mean it. You'll see the difference. Knudsen saw to his horror in the second batch of experiments that he did, he was wrong. The critical period was much longer than 200 days. He got it wrong. Now, if you know who I mean, had a postdoc who came up with that result, what would the boss have said? So look, what are you doing? We've already done this experiment. We know what the answer is. Why are you wasting your time? You get the wrong result. Why should I be bothered with that? But that's not what Knudsen did. Knudsen thought, why am I getting, and he could do that because he did the experiment. And then he thought, what's different? And it turns out he found a difference. The early experiments had been done with the owl, each little owlet in a box. So it had, it lived in the box, it had the prisms put on, put back in the box. The later set, where the critical period was longer, was done with the, with the birds in an aviary. It had an aviary built. So in the one case, the owl is sitting there saying, I wonder when the next meal is coming. I hate these glasses. When's he going to put me on that perch again? The others say, God, you should hear what my mother said to me. And they're all talking among each other. And they have an enriched environment. And that made the critical period longer. And he showed that this was not just anecdotally true by taking an owl that had been brought up in an aviary, putting it in a box, and its critical period became shorter. Or an owl that was in a box and putting it in the aviary, and its critical period became longer. So one can say it's not only in the visual system that there are critical periods. A colleague whom Robin knows well, Dongjin Zhou from China, who worked in my lab, has also shown there's a critical period in early life for the olfactory system. He plugged up one nostril, so that nostril no longer gets olfactory stimuli, and the arrangement of the glomeruli changes if you do it in early life, but not in adult life. So now we come up with an interesting thing. We've said that the visual system has hard wiring and soft wiring. This doesn't change, that doesn't change, that doesn't change. Just gone through four synapses. Photoreceptors, bipolar cells, bipolar ganglion, ganglion, geniculate cortex. And you've already got plasticity there, which you didn't have before. And the question is, how general are these critical periods? And you probably know much more about the experiment of Conrad Lorenz than I do because you're biologists. But as you know, Conrad Lorenz did beautiful experiments with ducklings of the East and showed there was a critical period for a duckling to recognize its mother. It recognized it by the sound quack. You may have seen those pictures of him walking along. Because he said quack to ducklings, and they all thought he was like their mother, and an electric train that went round in a circle went quack, 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 and the ducklings thought the train was their mother, but that had to be in the very early critical period. There are critical periods for dogs to be around human beings, and you can think of all sorts of other critical periods anecdotally. Huell and Meisel's experiments also have great clinical importance. Again, there's another message from this. They had no idea of this when they started the experiments. They did not put, we're doing these experiments to help newborn babies with cataracts. Never occurred to them. But after their experiments, it became possible to treat newborn babies that were premature, that had been in high oxygen, had cataracts of the lenses. What used to happen before was the ophthalmologist was called in and see a cloudy lens and say, oh, poor little baby, let's wait 6 months, take the lens out when he's stronger. And the baby was blind. And he said, of course he's blind, he's got a bad eye. Now they take the lens out immediately and the baby doesn't become blind. Just think of the millions of babies that will not be blind in the future through this treatment having been developed as a result of basic research that was done without any motive to help clinical neurology except squint, where it didn't work. So now what you have to do is think about this picture. You've said that this part is vulnerable, that part is not. So as you go higher in the brain, this is only the very beginning of the processing of visual information. This is the very first stage. This is going to be more plastic or less plastic going forwards. What do you think? The correct answer is, I don't know. But everything you know suggests that the higher you go in the cortex, the more the information is elaborated, the more plastic those functions will be, the more susceptible they will be to damage. And so you can then think about these things and think, maybe if we knew more about critical periods in early life, we'd know that at a certain period of development, the brain should be provided with certain stimuli. Say, for example, love, or affection, or discipline. Who knows? Can't say. And it would be good if you knew that. Because if you know that people without vitamin D have bent legs, then you cure that by giving them vitamin D. Nobody has rickets anymore. And this is not something that can be abused. It's a perfectly good thing to do. And one of the good reasons to do neurobiology is in your lifetime, you'll know about these areas. And you might be able to know what stimuli are important at what ages and what the critical periods are for those. That way, maybe you can bring your children up better than you were brought up. Thank you. We have 10 minutes of questions. I don't have time to do the other thing. No. I don't think, even if I do have time, I think it saturates people. I think they had enough, they had a whole hour, and I don't think it's worth giving another talk about. I don't mind, but I think it's a big mistake.
Perhaps we could post it on your blackboard and the students could watch it.
Sorry?
At home if they like.
No, I don't believe it.
No.
Not without an explanation.
Okay.
Sorry? Any questions? Because, you know, we could do something nice, something really nice. We can have any questions left, but you can finish early. Anybody wants to go, go. Don't stay here. Everything goes on too long. But I'm finished on time. We have 10 minutes of questions. You can ask any questions you like. Remember, this is not my field. I do this as a duty. I don't just lecture on what I did in the lab yesterday. Any questions? I planted some during the talk, which I think you might pick up.
I ask another question.
Yeah, you.
It's not illegal. Why does enrichment prolong the critical period rather than shorten it?
Okay. The answer to your question, the first answer to your question is every why question is more interesting than every how question, and you can never answer any why questions.
Well, what are the theories about why that might be?
Huber and Wiesel's great strength is they don't make theories about such things. It's not worth theorizing.
What about Knudsen?
What?
Knudsen. Did he have a theory about why the owl's critical period was longer?
Oh, no, he's a good scientist. He doesn't do that stuff. What Knudsen has done is shown a lot more about the nature of the critical period, how long it lasts. Mm-hmm. And you see, even enrichment, as he gives it, can never be real enrichment. Whatever you do is not as rich as what it was in nature.
Right.
So it's already deprivation being a lab animal. Sorry, I don't mean to be rude, but I'm incapable of making a theory. I wouldn't read it if they had. But read Hubel's book on visual perception about why it's not good to make theories.
In this experiment, can you actually see arborizations that
he hasn't looked at that. He hadn't looked at that as I saw it before. No. Yes.
When one eye is blindfolded, and
it's not blindfolded; they close the lids, but it does attribute. Yes.
Right. When the nerve from that eye that integrates the fourth layer, when it outcompetes the other one, does the other one degrade eventually?
No, it doesn't. It's just
still there.
The nerve is still alive. It's the axons that retract. The cell bodies get smaller. As far as I know, they don't actually die off.
So, Keith asked about right eye, left eye dominance. Does that have to do with the quality of vision, so one eye being more dominant than the other at birth, and therefore it?
I postponed his question because it was not relevant at the time, as you can see, and I postpone it now because I don't know the answer. I don't understand the reason for dominance at all. And some people have stronger dominance than others. For example, David Hubel is ambidextrous. He can write on the board, mirror writing. He can play the flute with one hand or with the other hand. Doesn't make any difference. Most people are not. So I don't know. I just cannot say. It's beyond me.
There, I feel that the histogram you showed more cells responding to one side.
That's
of
right. Yeah, exactly. So yes. Exactly.
Developmental lateral symmetry in the
right. It's something
more,
like
more
that.
Cells on one side.
Exactly. But that wouldn't show why, since the same thing is happening on the other side, why one hemisphere dominates over the other. I mean, this is a more general question. Why do you have a dominant hemisphere? I think we should finish early. Those of you that want to ask questions, come and ask me questions. Because you ought not, you have too much teaching anyway. There's two people talk to you too much.
I think the problem is now that when we start to lecture again, you're just going to say, oh, bring John back. Let's thank Dr. Nichols again.
It doesn't work.